but also, and normally, in criminal detection as well as in text interpretation. Many of the so-called deductions of Sherlock Holmes are instances of creative abduction. Sherlock Holmes speaks of observation and deduction. Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes was, as you know, enormously ignorant, except a few matters. There is a list of the knowledges of Sherlock Holmes drawn, outlined by Watson. Sherlock Holmes believed that the sun was turning around the earth. You know? And Conan Doyle didn't read Peirce, and so he believed, as many people believe, that what Holmes was doing was a case of deduction. In fact, it was abductions. I would have enough time to read you a story, which is not here, in the cardboard box, when Holmes detects what Watson was mumbling to himself, reading, so to speak, his train of thought only through some external features, the movement of his eyes, and so on. In fact, if we read attentively these two pages, and they are too much, we see that the train of thought Holmes imagined was a very creative one. And it was only by chance, we will see what kind of chance, that he coincided perfectly with Watson's actual one. But Holmes invented. Notice that in the universe of that story, ruled by a sort of complicity between the author and his characters, Watson could not have thought what he actually did think. So to falsify Holmes' attempt to guess his train of thought. Since Watson was paid by Conan Doyle, he answered, "That's correct." And but if the story world were the real world, Watson's stream of consciousness could have taken many other directions. Holmes is certainly trying to imitate the way Watson should have thought, since ars imitator natura in sua operazione, but he was obliged to choose among many possible Watson's mental courses, and probably he figured out many of them altogether, the one which displayed more aesthetic coherence or more elegance. Holmes, in fact, invented a story. He wrote a page of Ulysses, a stream of consciousness a la Joyce, ante litteram. It simply happened that the possible story was analogous to the actual one. Holmes was acting like Copernicus, thinking that his reconstruction was the more aesthetically elegant. But let's follow another train of thought, easier to follow, in the study in Scarlet, example 7 on the sheet, the train of thought that leads Holmes to infer that Watson went to the Wigmore Street post office to dispatch a telegram. I read it quickly with my English, but you can follow on the back. Holmes says, you know, observation shows that you have been to the Wigmore Street post office this morning, but deduction let me know that when there you dispatched a telegram. And when Watson says, oh, but how did you, and so on and so forth, it is the simplicity itself. You know that Holmes has never uttered elementary, my dear Watson. Philologists have demonstrated that in the corpus of Conan Doyle. That it was an invention of the... It is like all the historical phrases, you know, hic manebimus optime and things like that. It has been published recently, a book in New York, in which it is definitely told that Julius Caesar didn't say tu quoque Brute, but he did say it in Greek. It is simplicity itself, so absurdly simple that an explanation is superfluous, and yet it may serve to define the limits of observation and of deduction. Observation tells me that you have a little reddish mold adhering to your instep. Just opposite to the Wigmore Street office, they have taken up the pavement and thrown up some earth, which lies in such a way that it is difficult to avoid treading in it in entering. The earth is of this peculiar reddish tint, which is found, as far as I know, nowhere else in the neighborhood. So much is observation. The rest is deduction. How then did you deduce the telegram? Oh, why, of course I knew that you had not written a letter since I sat opposite to you all morning. I see also in your open desk that you have a sheet of stamps and a thick bundle of postcards. What could you go into the post office for then but to send a wire? Eliminate all the other factors, and the one which remains must be the truth. The only surprise, in fact, was that Watson had a little reddish mold adhering to his instep. As a matter of fact, in the 19th century London, not paved for motor cars, this fact was not so surprising. Holmes focused his attention upon Watson's shoes because he already had some idea in his mind. However, let's trust Conan Doyle and let's admit that this fact was in itself surprising enough. The first abduction is an overcoded one, first level. People with mud adhering to their instep have been in an unpaved place, etc., etc. The second abduction is an undercoded one, second type. Why Wigmore Street? Because its earth is of this particular tint. But why not suppose that Watson can have taken a cab, thus going beyond the neighborhood? Because the selection of the closest street meets reasonable criteria of economy. Watson was a very quiet person, pretty sick, was a bachelor, not women to meet somewhere. He marries at the end of this book, not before. So elementary, Watson was so narrow-minded that he couldn't have had some witty and brilliant idea, let's go to the Thames. No, the closest spot. Well, fine. But there were many possibilities. But these two abductions that in the Conan Doyle Holmes jargon are called mere observation, and they are not mere observation, but there are two procedures of this kind, do not say yet that Watson has been there for visiting the post office. Notice that if it is true that Holmes was, on the grounds of his world knowledge, in the position of thinking of the post office as the more probable goal for Watson, every evidence was against this supposition. Holmes knew for sure that Watson did not need any stamp or postcard. In order to think of the last probability, telegram, Holmes had to have already decided that Watson wanted to dispatch a cable. Can we imagine a judge who, having acquired strong evidence that a given defendant was not present at the right time on the scene of a crime concludes that, therefore, this person was committing at the same time another crime in another place. That is the train of thought of Holmes. Since Watson lacked 93% of reasons for going to the post office, Holmes decided that therefore Watson went there for the remaining 7% reasons. A curious hallucinatory 7% solution, indeed. To trust as plausible such a weak probability, Holmes must have assumed that Watson is in any case a regular post office goer. Only under this condition, the presence of stamps and postcards can be taken as the evidence that Holmes sent a cable. Holmes, thus, is not selecting among reasonable probabilities what would represent a case of first level or second level abduction. On the contrary, he is betting against all odds. He is inventing for the only sake of elegance. To shift from a creative abduction to the meta-abduction, my train of thought was the actual, corresponding to the actual train of things, is typical of a rationalistic mind in the vein of the 17th and 18th century rationalism. In order to reason as Holmes does, one must be strongly convinced that ordo et connexio idearum idem est ac ordo et connexio rerum, on the line of Spinoza. He must be very Leibnizian. For Leibniz, the expression can be similar to the expressed thing if a certain analogy between their respective structures is observed, since God, being the author of both things and minds, has engraved in our soul a thinking faculty that can operate in accordance with the laws of nature. Holmes can try meta-abductions only because he thinks that his creative abductions are justified by a strong link between mind and external world. Probably it is his rationalistic background which explains why he insists so much in calling deduction his kind of reasoning. In a universe ruled by an innate parallelism between res extensa and res cogitans, or by a pre-established harmony, the complete concept of an individual substance implies all its past and future predicates, Leibniz, prime veritatis. I don't know whether Conan Doyle knew Spinoza and Leibniz, but as a new Pierre Menard, he rewrote them in a more jocular way. Now, Peirce was concerned with this problem, and he said that we are succeeding in making abduction because of a certain lume naturale. He used this expression. A certain affinity between mind and nature. His affinity was more evolutionistic. He said the mind was so accustomed to interpret nature that at a certain point he has acquired the habit of thinking as nature does, in the same way in which two persons being married up after many, many years, they become similar each other. But even when asserting that general principles are really operative in nature, Peirce was always against Leibnizian rationalism. And Peirce held that conjectures are valid forms of inference insofar as they are nourished by previous observation, even though they may anticipate all their remote illative consequences. And the person's confidence in such an accordance between mind and course of events doesn't exclude fallibilism. the possibility of failing and of making mistake. For fallibilism is the doctrine that our knowledge is never absolute, but always swims, as it were, in a continuum of uncertainty and undeterminacy. Holmes, on the contrary, never goes wrong. Holmes has no doubts in meta-betting that the possible world he has outlined is the same as the real one. He has the privilege of living in a world built by Conan Doyle just to fit his egocentric needs, so he doesn't lack of immediate proofs of his perspicacity. Watson, narratively speaking, exists just in order to verify his hypothesis. What is this, Holmes? This is beyond anything I could have imagined. Right, but I confess that I don't see how you arrived at it. Watson, repeating compulsively. Watson represents the unquestionable guarantee that Holmes' hypothesis cannot be any longer falsified, a privilege that Karl Popper doesn't have. This lack of privilege having given him the chance of elaborating a logic of scientific discovery and not a poetics of criminal stories. Whereas in criminal stories, an omnipotent God verifies the hypothesis forever, in the real scientific inquiries, as well in real criminal medical or philological detection, meta-abductions are a frightening matter. Probably the true difference between abductions from fact to laws and abduction from facts to facts lies in the meta-abductional flexibility, that is, in the courage of challenging without further tests the basic fallibilism that governs human knowledge. That is why in real life detectives commit more frequent or more frequently visible errors than scientists. Detectives are rewarded by society for their impudence in betting by meta-abductions, whereas scientists are socially rewarded for their patience in testing their abductions. Nature, in order to have the intellectual and moral force to test and to ask for new tests and to entertain stubbornly an abduction before it has been definitely tested, also scientists need meta-abduction. Their difference from detectives stands in their refusal to impose their beliefs as a dogma, their firmness in not repudiating their motivated conjectures. Bertolt Brecht's Leben des Galilei is the story of such a difficulty of entertaining against everybody's once abduction, as well as it is the story of the continuous temptation of giving up with such an unfair guess. In fictional possible worlds, things go better. Nero Wolfe invents elegant solutions for inextricable situations, then gathers all the suspects in his room and spells out his story as if it were the case. Rex Stout is so kind to him as to make the real culpable to react, thus confessing his own guilt and acknowledging Wolfe's mental superiority. It would be enough that the real culpable said, "Are you crazy?" and every story of Rex Stout would collapse. Neither Galileo nor Peirce were so socially successful in their lives. And there should be also an epistemological reason for such misadventures. So I think that there is at least one point in which Peirce and science and Conan Doyle, criminal novelists, do not tell the same story, even though they play upon the same model. Thank you.
I refer to the article in Versus about the difference between abduction and hypothesis. Could you say a little bit more about that? Because I think
well, as far as I remember, I have to say again, the objection of Thagard was people frequently put together abduction and hypothesis. But for Peirce, there is a difference between the inference from result and rule to the case, this is the hypothesis, and inference from the result to the rule and the case, which is abduction. So he said, hypothesis is similar to overcoding in my theory of semiotics, because the rule is already there. When you have selected it, the hypothesis holds. While in abduction, since you have to pick it up from somewhere, you have to entertain it until a further test which allows you to transform the entertained hypothesis into a working hypothesis. That's the but the real difference was inference from result and rule together, already known to case, plain hypothesis, and inference from result to both rule and case. And I think he's right. Maybe it would be possible to find some other prose quotation falsifying, but substantially he's right. And it is on this line of thought that I have decided, well, but at this point there are not only two, there are three. That's what I tried to do. And probably there are 33 with different degrees of plausibility and certainty in exploring the range of possible rules. And the ideas of Thagard came from some seminars with David Savan and so on. But Thagard was presenting a first paper on this subject at the Amsterdam Press Congress, and then I asked him to develop the Eugene.
Umberto, could you figure the surrealist notion of objective chance as a form of abduction? And what would the meta-abductive model for that be?
It's not by chance that the first anthology of Peirce was called by the editors Chance, Love, and Logic. The idea of chance plays a certain role in Peirce's thought. And it's not by chance that he uses fair guess, guessing instinct. Because a Peirce is too much Catholic in listing abductions. For instance, the abduction studied by Sebeok, the stealing of the wrist of the watch on the Mississippi River boat, in which Peirce at a certain point says it must be the waiter, with a shade of racism. Peirce was not anti-racist, given the title. And so the waiter was black, and he went immediately at the home, entered and pushed away the wife, and went immediately at the piece of furniture in which he had guessed that the object should be there. This is a case in which Peirce doesn't explain the train of thought, which allows Sebeok, and the treatment of Sebeok is different from mine, to stress the elements of intuition and guess. I think that Peirce would have said that beneath every intuition there is a movement like that. But there are two possibilities of interpreting abductions. And the cases, for instance, Peirce gives examples like predicting the further course of a melody, a sensation in hearing music. So there is a strong moment of intuition, mere sensitivity, smell in abduction. And there are moments in which he was thinking of both things. The more intuitionist Peirce could serve as a starting point for a theory of guessing as chance, and I But I think that the surrealistic chance is different, because the result of a cadaverous key is due to the real intervention of chance. Provided that the surrealists were not so clever that when writing the new line without seeing the first one, they made some hypothesis about what could have Aragon written according to his way of thinking. Probably something like that. And then I practiced the cadaverous key sometime with some friends, and I tried to extrapolate from his normal way of thinking the possible sentences. So at this point, the surrealistic chance is no more a cosmical force, but it is an abductional ability and the profound knowledge of the surrealist encyclopedia on the part of the accomplice of the game. But so you see that schemes like that can help also to disambiguate some mystical notions like the surrealist notion of chance. But I am a rationalist.
I think it's a follow-up to these questions. You gave two reasons already for the way a creative abduction is made. One is elegance, a possible word which would be beautiful. And the second is intuition, guessing, etc. What could it have be like? Is there a place for a third possibility? In fact, while analyzing Sherlock Holmes' creative abduction, in that example, I think that he in fact suspected Watson had to send a telegram from the case. So in fact, he already had a guess before he started justifying it by various procedures, logical abductions, etc. Extrapolating to other cases, usually there is an idiosyncrasy in the guesser about how he wants the world to be, and then proceeding from that complete picture, which he wants to be correct, then he sets up the whole picture of logical or quasi-logical abductions. Is this somehow included in your?
Yeah, but I would say I agree, but there is more. I arrived at outlining this third level of creation, but now what we need is a semiotics of creation. You never create ex nihilo. Not even Copernicus was inventing that only for pure symmetrical reasons. To create is to walk very fast around the encyclopedia. To find other possible schemes which have not as yet become laws, but which could. It means for Sherlock Holmes to have a certain knowledge of the general habits of Watson. To know, as I said, that Watson was so narrow-minded that he had few possibility of spending his time. Moreover, we know that Watson has a brother in bad conditions. I don't remember where there is a story of the watch of the brother by which Holmes detects everything about the brother Watson. And so Holmes, as well as Copernicus, is, let me use this metaphor, walking around the encyclopedia, picking up small clues, marginal evidences, and say, well, according to the normal way of thinking, or to the normal way of doing, or to the normal way in which a culture works, this law could be invented. And so there is always a certain keyboard of possible laws. I can compose certain melodies on the keyboard if I assume that probably the tonal system is the right one. I think that there is an operation of this kind. The same we implement in building up metaphors and in interpreting them. And maybe something more to so. There is a semiotics of creation to be developed on this line.
Understanding of aesthetics that you're living as implicit to someone like Sherlock Holmes is a very classical understanding of aesthetics. That is to say, beauty is implied by a certain form of classical or even neoclassical elegance. And this is related to a certain conception of logic. And very often, intentionally, Sherlock Holmes tries to act according to these standards.
Paolo, I missed, there was a noise there, I missed the last sentence.
Very often, Sherlock Holmes does indeed try to act according to these standards of classical elegance and logic. But as you yourself have said, he very often gives only a 7% solution. And I think the last question was getting at the fact that Sherlock Holmes very often acts on hunches, various kinds of hunches, which logically are not really abductions, but more directions from a logical path. And he somehow comes out with the right conclusion. And yet he's not always right. Moriarty is always one step ahead of Sherlock Holmes. And Sherlock Holmes never catches up with him. In a sense, Sherlock Holmes is a very quixotic figure. He believes he's logical, but in fact he's very grotesque. He follows a grotesque logic. And I wonder whether in semiotics too, there's very often a desire for a classical logic with a certain conception of aesthetics. That is to say, the understanding of texts as instances or tokens of codes. And yet in the semiotic process, what we come to realize is not that the text is an instance of a code, but that it plays with various codes, and often is involved in rather grotesque directions.
Yes, I agree, provided we distinguish what is elegance in logic, what is elegance in aesthetics, and what is, let me say, elegance, for three times I have used the metaphor, obviously, in rhetoric. Holmes doesn't follow logical patterns. If we conceive of logic in the form of analytic logic, Holmes follows rhetorical patterns according to the way in which people think, which is not according to a formal criterion of correctness, and sometimes certain aesthetic criteria. For instance, the page from the cardboard box, I didn't read. But Holmes reconstructs the train of mind, as he says, of Watson according to certain narrative model of the Victorian Edwardian era. Is not following logical consequences. He's writing down a good page of 19th century literature. And in abducing, we were just discussing in between with Eugene, the invention of the middle term is not a logical move, it's a rhetorical move. Is following a criterion of endoxon, plausibility, verisimilarity. It's very interesting that the core of the logical thought of Aristotle, the theory of definition, cannot be explained in logical terms. Now, if there is a task for semiotics, it is probably to recognize the different rules and the different way of functioning of these three absolutely different universes. The logical one, which in natural languages works only 0.05%, the rhetorical one, and the aesthetic one. The distinction would be that the rhetorical is, well, it lasts since 2,000 years and it is more or less the same, while the aesthetic models of elegance and completeness change faster. That's another interesting point. We are rhetorically thinking as in Aristotle's rhetoric. We have changed very, very, very little if you take a speech of Reagan or of the Italian president. The laws are the same as those outlined by Aristotle and by the sophists, while if you take a modern poem, it's different from a Renaissance poem. But there are three different criteria. Well, it would be interesting to see whether Holmes is more sensitive to a sort of generalized rhetoric typical of a well-educated man at the time, or whether he is following certain literary models of the 19th century English literature that Holmes, not Holmes, Conan Doyle, because Holmes had no literary knowledge. He knew only about surprising facts, crimes, poisons, and few other. But I don't know. That there is a web of question there. But the existence of this web is a semiotic problem, not a logical one.